From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump signs more executive orders today, one rolling back the Dodd-Frank banking restrictions put in place after the 2008 financial crisis. Wags are circulating a tweet Trump sent out in 2012 asking, "Why is Barack Obama constantly issuing executive orders, making power grabs of authority?"
There's also a new Supreme Court nominee this week and much more to talk about in our Friday roundtable. And joining us today is Maria Elena Salinas, Univision News anchor. Hi, Maria Elena.
Hello. Nice to talk to you, like always.
Great to have you. And Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor, is with us as well. Hi, Domenico.
Hey there.
And Domenico, how do you think that the Trump presidency is going so far? We're 2 weeks in. So much has happened already.
Wow, it really has. 14 days of this, and it is some rocky waters. I mean, Donald Trump is trying to follow through on the promises that he made, some of the biggest promises he made during the campaign. You know, a lot of people talked about that border wall with Mexico. He said that he wants to try to get that built. He put an executive order out on that. He talked about the Muslim ban, which he's not calling a Muslim ban anymore, but does ban people from seven majority Muslim countries. So for all the people who said that we shouldn't take Trump literally but take him seriously, I think we really should and have done both.
Well, what about places where his voters might say he's fallen behind on his promises? I'm thinking of Obamacare and the phrase, "We're going to repeal Obamacare." And now you have Tennessee Senator Lamar Alexander saying it's more accurate to say repair Obamacare. So, Maria Elena, what does that signal?
Well, one of the things that surprises me the most is that Republicans have been trying for years now to repeal Obamacare, and it surprises me that they didn't already have something ready to replace it, that now they're struggling trying to figure out how to do that. And this is probably one of those things where Trump didn't know either how to replace it and is relying on Congress to do that job for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, it looks like a lot of Trump supporters are still supporting him, but then there's others that are having second thoughts and wondering, why did I vote for him?
One of the big pieces of news this week was the Supreme Court nomination of Neil Gorsuch, Judge Neil Gorsuch. And there's a question about whether Senate Republicans will pull the nuclear option where they would change the rules in the Senate to require fewer votes to confirm Gorsuch, fewer than the 60 that are typically done for Supreme Court nominees. Trump told them to do that. Here he is.
But if we end up with that gridlock, I would say, if you can, Mitch, go nuclear, because that would be an absolute shame if a man of this quality was caught up in the web. So I would say it's up to Mitch, but I would say go for it. Okay?
He's talking about Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. Domenico, Democrats in a bind here trying to figure out what to do, whether to fight Neil Gorsuch and have the rules changed so that it only requires a majority, or try to hold their fire for the next one.
Well, what's interesting here is that, you know, we were talking a minute ago about whether or not Trump supporters would be disappointed. I think there's almost no reason for Trump supporters to be disappointed. Things that we've heard from them have been that they are completely in backing Donald Trump. They love that he has shaken up the rules.
Especially in this nomination.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this nomination, it delivers on something that he had promised. He promised a list of people who would be conservative for those folks who didn't like Donald Trump's moral values, et cetera. But, you know, when it comes to Democrats, on the other hand, they are being pressured, facing huge political pressure from the left. And this is not in Democrats' DNA to sort of shut government down, to stop things from happening. They want to be able to govern. And also, you know, they also understand the political reality here. They may be able to stop Neil Gorsuch and get an eye for a Garland eye. You know, Merrick Garland was the person who was Barack Obama's pick who was stopped by Republicans. They could do that. They could push Neil Gorsuch to the side. But to what end? The Republicans, if they get rid of the filibuster after that, could get through as conservative a pick, if not more conservative, and have only 51 votes needed for the next one, if and when there is a next one.
And what about the the front of the administration, you know, the front, the public face, if you will. How's the messaging going? We're thinking of Kellyanne Conway, who launched a Twitter storm when she referenced the Bowling Green massacre that was underreported. Well, that's because it didn't happen. There were two Iraqis who were jailed, one for life, from Bowling Green for sending money to Iraqi insurgents. But there was no massacre. And Conway said today that she meant to say Bowling Green terrorists. And people, I'm looking online, sure. People have always put up, there's now a Bowling Green massacre fund for the victims of the Bowling Green massacre that did not happen. But the Esquire headline is, the Bowling Green massacre is fake. Mentally ill Americans getting easier access to guns is real. They're referring to Republicans repealing a rule that would make it harder for the mentally ill to get guns. Now it will be easier. You know, how is the sort of the face of the administration doing with missteps like that? And how about, you know, are we maybe looking at the wrong things?
Well, look, I think that as far as the Bowling Green massacre goes, that quote unquote, that didn't happen. You know, it's very easy for people to pile on what Kellyanne Conway was saying and doing there. And there's no question she was wrong in the scope of what she was saying, but it doesn't matter to Trump supporters. You
right.
know, it's not something that they are going to latch on to. It's something that, frankly, liberals are fired up about. But I do think the real thing here is that the messaging, not only just the messaging, but the rollout, the management of that visa ban, for example, that was problematic. There were a lot of questions, not only internally within the United States, with Republicans questioning whether or not this administration knows how to govern or is capable of governing. And then with relationships around the world, there were a lot of people scratching their heads and questioning the competence of this government by the way that was rolled out. Mike Pence went to Capitol Hill yesterday and basically said, we learned our lesson.
If I can add to that, yeah. I think it's interesting how the administration is constantly attacking the media and saying, you know, we're responsible for fake news. Yet you're getting all these alternative facts from his supporters and from his surrogates and from pundits that support him on television. And, you know, where's the truth? And that is a serious problem. I'm very, very concerned because one of the first things that you see in an authoritarian government is trying to suppress and trying to undermine the media, trying to limit the freedom of the press. So we have out there a population that is ill-informed, and that actually makes them not ignorant but also vulnerable to lies. Nobody knows what to believe anymore.
Maria Elena, I want to ask you how this whole back and forth with Mexico is playing out, especially among Latinos in the United States. Trump with some tough words, talking about bad hombres. How's this all playing out?
Well, this whole thing, as you know, the White House and Los Pinos in Mexico, the Mexican government, have denied that he threatened to send troops. But it seems like there's also some sources that are saying, well, he didn't necessarily threaten. He kind of offered, and it was sort of like a joke. But, you know, in an interview with our Enrique Acevedo, the foreign minister of Mexico, Videgaray, said that decisions that are made in the next few months will mark U.S.-Mexico relations for decades to come. So while Mexicans are proud people, you know, they're also pragmatic, and they realize that you can't alienate yourself from your neighbor. So they have to do this juggling act to preserve their dignity at home while also finding some kind of common ground with the new administration in the U.S. They have no choice.
Because of important things like trade. I want to ask you, sticking with the tough phone call with the Mexican president and also with the Australian prime minister, what about the leaking of some of this, Domenico? Persistent leaks, executive orders about those tough phone calls. You know, some have said that it's long-time workers inside the White House, inside the administration, who've worked for, you know, two parties, who are sort of making these SOS calls to the media. Do you believe that?
Well, I don't know who the leaks are coming from. None of them have come through NPR in our reporting. But I will say that it does reflect a certain level of concern within those in the government who have been within the government or those who are within Trump's administration and who didn't exactly think that some of the actions that the president took were necessarily the right ones to take, and that it raised some flags for them. There's also a way to look at it where one way to communicate with Trump when you're in the White House and the advice that you've given him has maybe been pushed aside is to be quoted in the media or seen on TV. And that's one way to get to the principal to let him know what your dissent is and that maybe he should curtail some of his actions.
Maria Elena, just about 30 seconds left here, but we saw Donald Trump with some business leaders today where we were talking at the top about he wants to roll back some of the financial regulations that went in after the 2008 collapse. How's that going to play with for a guy who ran as a populist? I mean, are ordinary Americans going to like seeing him with all these Wall Street people and doing things that they love?
Well, you know, the answer to that is easy. Trump supporters will support anything he does, and his opponents will criticize it. But what happened to accusing Hillary of being too close to Wall Street? Now he is getting close to Wall Street. Sooner or later, I think people are going to start, realizing what's going on and that he's picking and choosing the promises that he wants to keep. And, you know, we'll see if that 42% that support him now will continue supporting him or that number will go down.
On the other hand, his supporters are saying this is what they want to see, and that's where they want to be. They want to be in that room. Maria Elena Salinas, Univision News anchor, Domenico Montanaro, NPR politics editor. Great as always. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The U.S. is writing a new chapter in U.S.-Russian relations as Donald Trump takes office. But a wonderful book out in paperback this month reminds us how storied Russia's own history already is. That's the Seventh Symphony of Dmitri Shostakovich. It can move you to tears, but if you know its history, it will make you weep. Shostakovich wrote it during the siege of Leningrad by the Nazis. Now, siege doesn't mean seize. It means cut off, and Leningrad was cut off, almost strangled to death. Author M.T. Anderson tells that story, but also takes us back to when Shostakovich was born in 1906. His family witnessed to the Workers' Revolution of 1917, which overthrew the Tsar. The second revolution then brought the communists and Lenin to power. A young Shostakovich included a factory whistle and communist songs in his pieces. But then Lenin was replaced by Stalin, his cruelty only matched by Hitler's, and we hear it all in the music. M.T. Anderson's book for young adults that adults loved as well is Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. It was long listed for the National Book Award in 2015, which M.T. won in 2006 for his novel about a young man named Octavian Nothing. And in 2015, M.T. Anderson stopped by our studios. Take us first to the early 1920s. Lenin leads the country. Shostakovich was studying and composing.
Absolutely. So, St. Petersburg, or as it became Leningrad, was really the center of the arts and of literature in Russia at that time. This is this great moment where we're going to break all the rules. Music will sound totally different. Painting is going to be abstract geometrical shapes.
Cubes.
Exactly, right. So it was this incredibly exciting time, and he was there as a very, very young man, really a boy, trying to create symphonies that were new symphonies that sounded nothing like what had come before.
This is his third symphony, the 1st of May. Well, and I'm skipping quite a bit through history here, but Lenin dies and then comes Stalin.
You go from this moment of incredible expansion and excitement and a feeling of youth to one of fear and conservatism. And that's not to say that there wasn't a lot of violence earlier, but nonetheless, just in the arts themselves, you start to, there's a real change where people start to withdraw. There starts to be much more sort of a return to realism, to the things that had been before, but now with a kind of a proletarian cast to them.
Well, and Shostakovich comes on Stalin's radar. He writes the 1932 opera Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk District, a success at first. Let's listen. Stalin came to a performance.
And he absolutely hates it. And supposedly, as he walked out partway through the performance, he supposedly growled to some reporter, "That's not music, it's just a mess." Well, whether he said that or not, an article by that title appeared in Pravda, "A Mess Instead of Music." And in that, Shostakovich was used as kind of like the whipping boy of communism. He was supposed to be neurotic and bourgeois, and he was only playing to the elite. There was nothing that was here for the common man. All of the previous praise of the opera disappeared.
And this sense of Stalin starts to make its way into his music. Talk about the Fourth Symphony, is it?
Yeah, and we never know what music absolutely means. But it's certainly true that in his Fourth Symphony, you can really hear a sense at the end where you are supposed to have this kind of Soviet realist burst of success and triumph, kind of Soviet triumphalism. Well, instead of that, in this symphony, you end with this kind of chilling, crystalline scene that it just sounds like utter devastation.
Again, I'm pushing through your account here to get to Hitler's invasion. And as you remind us, Stalin actually enabled him to attack because he had decimated most of his own forces by killing his own people. But just as this is going on, Hitler invading, tying a noose around Leningrad, what's happening to Shostakovich?
He actually did get trapped inside the city. He kept on being offered trips out. People would say, look, the ballet is fleeing. Come with us. And he kept on saying, no, I really want to stay here and finish this piece, the Leningrad Symphony, which is about the city. I need to finish it in my city.
Symphony number seven.
And his wife was saying, we have two infant children. We should get out of here. And Shostakovich kept on delaying and delaying. And then finally, it was too late. The Germans had surrounded the city, and he and his family were trapped there.
They do get out, though.
They do. They do finally escape, and they flee to Moscow, which, of course, then merely days after they get there, is itself attacked and besieged. And he ends up fleeing again to the east on a refugee train.
But he eventually finishes his symphony. So let's listen to some of Symphony No. 7. Let's start with the very beginning.
The piece opens really with a sense of kind of boldness. It's very positive. It sort of strides forward at the beginning. But then, partway through this first movement, there's a surprise. Shostakovich abandons all of that early material that sounds so positive and so celebratory, and instead you get this irritating little march. And this march starts very far away, but gets louder and louder and louder. It's repeated again and again, kind of like the, you know, bolero of death or something, until finally becomes absolutely brutal and screaming. And this, people at the time saw as being a depiction of the German approach to the city.
You write in great depth about what that does, not just the bombing of the city, but the cutting it off from the rest of the world. No food, no water. It's interesting to us that this is a book for young readers, because this makes the very popular zombie films pale.
Well, and it is very sobering that all of it is real. I mean, as a joke, I said to my editor when I presented it to her, think of it as a dystopian novel that actually happens to be entirely real.
Yeah. Well, and tell us more about how this story made its way into music. And again, it's Hitler and the Siege of Leningrad, but it's Stalin before Hitler.
Right. There's no question that everyone was reading it as a symphony about a beautiful city that is then invaded by the Germans. But since then, people have started to say, well, is it also about Stalin? Is it only about Stalin? And I think that the likelihood is, as Shostakovich himself said privately to friends, that it was in many ways not simply a depiction of the German advance, but also of a kind of a bondage of the spirit that can spread within us all.
You describe an incredible moment when the music is kind of smuggled back into Leningrad so that the completely decimated Leningrad Symphony, 15 starving people, could perform it. They were so emaciated, so near death, that in fact, during rehearsals, they would die. They would pitch forward in their chairs and die.
Well, they had to supplement the orchestra. It had to be more than 100 players in the end, and it was very hard to do so. They went around from house to house, knocking on doors and finding these people who were dying of starvation and saying, look, we'll give you extra rations if you will come and play in this orchestra. And this orchestra that has been brought back from the dead played this piece, and it was broadcast through all the streets. It was broadcast across the radio, and it was broadcast across no man's land at the German gun emplacements. And in fact, the conductor, years later, was approached by some German tourists, and they said to him, we were in the German trenches, and we heard you play that symphony that night. And they said, the night we heard you play the Leningrad Symphony was the night we knew we would never take Leningrad.
Remind us that people came, skeletal people came. They could have been bombed. The Germans could have bombed that one place and probably wiped out much of Leningrad. They came to hear music.
Because it was incredibly important to them. And this resounds throughout all of the diaries I read and all of the accounts of this siege. It was incredibly important to people to find ways to remember to be human. Because they'd been reduced below the level of animals in some ways. And that's what this was for them. They were so proud of the fact that here was a symphony about them. I mean, many of them knew that when the news from Leningrad was being repeated in the rest of Russia, the news would not actually even admit that people were starving in the city, even while people were starving by the tens of thousands on some days. Here, though, was them cast as the hero. Here they are cast in a role as being those who shall triumph one day. And that was so important to them.
M.T. Anderson, the book is Symphony for the City of the Dead, Dmitri Shostakovich and the Siege of Leningrad. Thank you so much. You've done it again.
Thank you.
Our conversation with author M.T. Anderson in 2015, his wonderful book, comes out in paperback next Tuesday.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
This weekend marks the end of an exhibit at Alcatraz, the famous island prison in the San Francisco Bay. It's an abstract piece involving football and math, aimed at pushing back at a prison sentencing system the artist sees as unfair. Ryan Levy from Here and Now contributor KQED has more.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Rock.
Hundreds of colorful NFL jerseys are strung on clothesline, winding along the left side of a cold gray cement building at the former Alcatraz Federal Penitentiary. It's about as long as a football field, and the jerseys are part of an art installation called Shortening, making the irrational rational. New York artist Nelson Sayers is the creator. He says the numbers on the jerseys aren't random, but instead spell out the first several hundred digits of the number pi.
Pi is what's called an irrational number, which means it never ends nor repeats. Now, the way to turn it into a rational number is to shorten it. And so that's a metaphor for what needs to be done in these irrational prison sentences.
Sayers isn't necessarily the kind of person you'd expect to create protest art. He's a 41-year-old gangly white guy with brown hair. He's got a PhD in math, and he used to be a hedge fund manager in New York before becoming a full-time artist. But a conversation he had almost 2 years ago started him on the path to Alcatraz.
It was like 2 or 3 in the morning. I was talking to a buddy of mine who grew up in a very rough neighborhood in the Bronx.
It was spring 2015, just after Freddie Gray, a black man in Baltimore, died due to injuries sustained while in police custody. And Sayers was asking his friend what he thought.
And he said, well, number one thing, they got to get rid of football numbers because it's destroying families, destroying entire communities.
Football numbers is a prison term for long prison sentences.
And it comes from the idea that if you get 30 years or 44 years or 25 years, it's a number that looks like a number on a football jersey. So the football jerseys hanging in the room point to that expression.
Many of those long prison sentences involve nonviolent drug crimes, and they date back to tough-on-crime efforts like California's 1994 three-strikes law. But California prison spokeswoman Chrissy Hohobashvili says those kinds of sentences have become less common in California. But, Hohobashvili adds, it's not a settled issue.
While those changes have happened and continue to happen, you will still find people in state prison who are serving long sentences, life sentences.
Sayers isn't the first artist to use Alcatraz as a platform for protest. Perhaps most famously in 2014, Chinese activist artist Ai Weiwei staged an exhibition there about freedom and confinement that attracted nearly 900,000 people.
Right next to us, you'll see the Chicago Bears jersey number 85.
Sayers says he chose Alcatraz because he thought staging the exhibit at a famous prison might help people better understand his highly abstract work of art.
Having the backdrop be Alcatraz would certainly point people in the direction that this is about prisons. Because otherwise, you know, you'd come in and see a room of football jerseys with strange numbers on it and duct tape and things like that. You may not naturally think about prison sentences.
Even with the prison backdrop, some people still don't get it. A fair number of visitors do a quick loop through the jerseys without really stopping. But those that do, like Galen Tom, an artist from Fairfield, California, says the unique setting does the trick.
It really sends a message, especially when you don't get it at first and you think, oh, I'm in a prison, I see this, and I'm going through it, and these numbers represent people who served years, some low, some high, in drug-related offenses. It definitely hits at home of understanding and seeing the gloom of the interior of this place.
Tom says even though some people may not understand the piece, staging it on Alcatraz guarantees one thing, a big audience. And he's right. More than 80,000 visitors have walked through Sayers' jerseys since the exhibition opened last July. For Here and Now, I'm Ryan Levy in San Francisco.
It's been a tempestuous couple of days on social media, and we're not even talking about the president, who has two Twitter accounts and uses them. There was also a Twitter storm over a massacre that never happened. Femi Okeh is host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. She's in Washington. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Robin.
Well, we mentioned this earlier. Let's flesh this out. In an interview on MSNBC yesterday, White House counselor Kellyanne Conway defended Donald Trump's travel plans, saying Obama did something similar, banning Iraqi refugees after the Bowling Green massacre. Well, President Obama did not ban Iraqi refugees, and there was no Bowling Green massacre. Just clarify.
All right, so here are the facts. In 2011, two Iraqi men were arrested in Bowling Green in Kentucky. They were arrested and eventually sentenced and are currently serving time, one for 40 years and one for life. And their sentence is linking back to activities they were doing attacking U.S. troops in Iraq and also a plot and to send money to Al-Qaeda as well. So those were actions that were taking place overseas, but they were arrested and found in Bowling Green, Kentucky. That is probably how Kellyanne Conway got a little bit mixed up. And following that sentence, those charges, the Obama administration just reviewed who it was that was coming from Iraq and just looked at those vetting process.
Well, she's retracted today, saying she misspoke, that she meant to say terrorist instead of a massacre. But how's social media reacting?
Well, let me just remind you that Kellyanne Conway was the person from the Trump team who actually said there are alternative facts. Twitter was not dealing with this kindly. David Waldman, for instance, was saying, where were you on the day it didn't happen? Hashtag never remember. Hashtag Bowling Green massacre. And Zach Lowe talks about the Bowling Green massacre as, well, it wasn't it that football game where Ohio State scored 77 and Bowling Green scored 10. That was the Bowling Green massacre. And then also referencing how Kellyanne Conway was been talking about her mistake. She says, honest mistakes abound. I meant to say Bowling Green terrorists, not massacre. This continues to rumble on online, but there is, in fact, no Bowling Green massacre.
Just to be clear. Yeah. Okay, moving on. Travis Kalanick, the CEO of Uber, the ride-hailing company, was pressured to remove himself from President Trump's Economic Advisory Council. He was criticized for Uber keeping up business while taxis struck at JFK Airport over Donald Trump's travel ban. And he seems to have been forced to change his mind because of a hashtag campaign, the Delete Uber campaign. What happened there?
Well, when people at JFK Airport saw that Uber was doing really good business, when New York taxi drivers said, you know what, we are going to support the travel ban protesters. We are going to support them. We are going to go on strike for an hour. We're not going to help and show our solidarity with this campaign, with this protest. Well, Uber announced that they were going to be available and there was not going to be any high prices particularly. People got very upset about that. They thought it was like, maybe you're supporting President Donald Trump. Maybe you're supporting this travel ban. And so the hashtag delete Uber spread.
Well,
big time.
Yeah.
Apparently there have been something like 200,000 people who asked for their Uber account to be deleted. Uber drivers were really unhappy. They were become extremely unpopular. And in a meeting this week, they asked their CEO to show them more support. He said, I'm going to set up a fund for drivers who may be impacted by this immigration travel
A $3 million legal defense fund, yeah.
Exactly. That wasn't enough, though, for them. And he said, well, what else do you need me to do? And they said, well, we would like you to step down from President Trump's Economic Advisory Council, which is what he did on Thursday. But if you take a look at the top of his Twitter account, just 4 days ago, he says, I'm going to use my President's Economic Council seat to stand up for what's right. So within a couple of days, he was pushed to change his mind. So now he's no longer on that council. He stepped back.
Mm. Well, the anti-Trump group Grab Your Wallet is claiming a success. This is the other social media campaign, and they say that they're one of the reasons that Nordstrom is announcing it will drop Ivanka Trump's brand name clothing and shoes. But I just want to ask you, there's also a move, just really briefly, a social media fight to have a national holiday after the Super Bowl.
There is. So Robin, all those other hashtags we've been talking about, I mean, this is very potent activism. Things have changed within just a couple of days.
Right.
People have changed their minds. CEOs have stood down. Clothes have come out of shops. This one, I'm not sure will work. Kraft Heinz, the company, are giving all of their employees the day off on Monday. According to their research, 60 million people either phone in sick, don't turn up for work after the Super Bowl. And they are behind this movement to let's make the Monday after Super Bowl a national holiday.
I have
a feeling that this is one hashtag campaign that actually won't work.
Yeah, maybe it shouldn't either. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, staying with the Super Bowl, of course, a battle between the New England Patriots and the Atlanta Falcons. It's also the annual advertising skirmish with brands paying, about $5 million for 30 seconds of airtime. And among the 50 spots this year, a higher than usual number of issue-related ads, says John Carroll here, now media analyst. We bring him in now. Hi, John.
Hi, Robin.
And let's take a listen to one from Audi. This is the German car maker. It features a dad watching his daughter compete in a soapbox derby.
What do I tell my daughter? Do I tell her that her grandpa's worth more than her grandma? That her dad is worth more than her mom? Do I tell her that despite her education, her drive, her skills, her intelligence, she will automatically be valued as less than every man she ever meets?
Boy, you know, talking about income inequity there and value inequity, serious ad. And that's not unusual, though.
No, it's not. There have been serious ads on a number of Super Bowls. And back in 2006, there was a Dove ad about young girls' self-esteem. In 2012, there was Clint Eastwood's Halftime in America. 2013, there was God Made a Farmer for Dodge Ram trucks. So it's not unusual at all.
Right. It plays at the heartstrings. Now, look, some of the issue-related ads may not be. Let's listen to this one for Budweiser.
You don't look like you're from around here.
Warum bist du aus Deutschland?
So we're seeing an immigrant make his way, maybe from Ellis Island. I mean, it's almost like a film. Now, this came out Saturday, right after President Trump signed the bans on immigrant travel. People thought, smackdown from Budweiser. But what does Budweiser say?
But Budweiser says that this is just part of their history. This is Adolphus Busch making his way from Germany to America to fulfill his dream of brewing beer. Essentially, they say, look, this is about our heritage. This is about the chasing the American dream. There's nothing connected to the immigration. However, that's not how everyone sees it. And there's been a lot of pushback on this one.
Right. They're saying there's no connection with anything else happening in the country, but perception's reality. And some people think it is, so they're going to debate that. Meanwhile, actress Melissa McCarthy has one for Kia. It shows her as like a hapless eco-do-gooder. Let's listen.
Hey, Melissa, the whales need your help.
I love whales!
Go, Melissa!
Oh, boy.
That was a whale.
That's a whale. What happened here?
Threw her up in the air against the side of the boat. The next thing, she goes off to save the trees. The tree she's saving gets cut down. then she goes to save the polar ice cap. She splits the polar ice cap. and then the rhino, the endangered rhino, you really just don't want to know about that. It's a funny ad, though.
But it does, I mean, it reminds people that those are issues.
Absolutely. Yeah, right. And they tie it into the car at the end.
And Tostitos is going to tackle drunk driving. Let's listen to a little.
On the day of the big game, almost 70% of the accidents that we see are alcohol related.
They're not really focused on how they got to get home after they have that good time. You know, once you have a few drinks, that kind of goes out the window.
John, your thoughts?
Yeah, the snack maker has distributed 25,000 Tostitos products with coupons, a $10 off coupon for Uber, for Sunday night, for use on Sunday night.
That's kind of cool. Although some people object to, you know, having an issue like drunk driving when you know people are going to be drinking while they have your product.
Well, Budweiser had Helen Mirren last year, right, who did a fabulously funny spot.
Okay, Snickers says it's going to have the first live Super Bowl spot, but it's really not the first one.
No, according to Ad Age, Schlitz had the first live Super Bowl spot in 1981. There was a 7-second delay, but that taste test gets the first nod.
It'll still be fun to see if Snickers screws it up live.
You never know.
John Carroll, media analyst for Here and Now, mass communication professor at Boston University. We'll link you to his campaign outsider blog at hereandnow.org. John, happy viewing.
Likewise.
And there are a lot of questions being asked at UC Berkeley this week after protests on campus against the far-right commentator Milo Yiannopoulos turned violent and caused $100,000 worth of damage. Berkeley canceled Yiannopoulos' speech because of the violence. Troy Warden is a member of the College Republicans, which invited Yiannopoulos to campus. He joins us via Skype. And Troy, were you surprised at the reaction to Yiannopoulos coming to Berkeley?
You know, I can't say I was. But I honestly didn't expect the level of violence at the event. We didn't expect these outside groups to arrive and use fireworks and flares and explosives and to break windows and basically riot.
But you believe that those who were violent, those who were breaking windows, et cetera, were outside groups and not students at Berkeley?
Well, I'd like to emphasize that the use of flares and these explosives did come from a group which the university believes is called a Black Bloc, and they seem to be some sort of paramilitary anarchist group that's been around since the 90s. But I would say that the students there definitely were encouraging the violence. They were cheering, they didn't stop the attackers, and they were dancing as the campus burned. So this was far from just outside groups coming in and agitating. I think the students encouraged it.
So for people who don't know who Milo Yiannopoulos is, he's a far-right editor and writer at Breitbart News. He was famously banned from Twitter last summer for actively inciting people to harass Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones, also of Saturday Night Live. She is black. He says mainstream Muslim culture is the problem. Why invite somebody like that to campus?
Well, there are two reasons why we wanted to invite Mr. Yiannopoulos to campus. The first is the fact that he's a controversial speaker, and therefore he's a great way to expose a lot of liberal students at Berkeley, who make up a majority of the student body, to different views. And the second reason is free speech. The fact that we were unable to invite someone, whoever we choose, to speak at the university safely just goes to show that the home of the free speech movement is also the free speech movement's resting place.
But why invite somebody like this? I mean, just being controversial, is that a reason to bring somebody into a campus if what he is saying many people view as hate speech?
Well, many people view it as hate speech, but again, I don't think Mr. Yiannopoulos' words meet the legal standard. As far as I know, cases haven't been successfully brought against Milo for his supposed hate speech. And also, I think that we should seek to invite someone who really challenges the majority opinion on campus. I think it's a shame that students aren't able to distinguish, furthermore, between Mr. Yiannopoulos' performance and his facts, because he says things in a provocative way, but there's actually substance behind them. So when he talks about mainstream Muslim culture, he's going to give you statistics about how many gays are killed, what laws are on the books in Saudi Arabia. And so I think people should really be able to look at the hard facts and debate Milo on those terms rather than just taking issue with the style he presents those things.
Well, another thing that he has said that is controversial and actually was part of what 100 faculty members, more than 100 faculty members at Berkeley put in their letter opposing his visit to campus involved a speech that he gave at the University of Wisconsin, and he called out a transgender student by name and put up her photo in front of an audience, and here's what he said. Let's listen.
He got into the women's room the way liberals always operate, using the government and the courts to weasel their way where they don't belong. In this case, he made a Title IX complaint. Title IX is a set of rules to protect women on campus effectively. It's couched in the language of equality, but it's really about women, which under normal circumstances would be fine, except for how it's implemented. Now it is used to put men into women's bathrooms. I have known some passing trannies in my life. Trannies, you're not allowed to say that either. I've known some passing trannies in my life, which is to say, transgender people who pass as the gender they would like to be considered. Well, no. The way you know that he's failing is I'd almost still bang him. It's just a man in a dress, isn't it?
So, Troy, what about something like that? Do you think that's acceptable speech and that's an acceptable thing to do to a student to make fun of them in that way?
Again, this is a whether or not this actually constituted legally harassment is up for debate. To my knowledge, a case was not brought against Milo for that incident. And I think, again, we should err on the side of more free speech, not less free speech. Now, keep in mind the Berkeley College Republicans don't endorse everything Milo says or all of his tactics, but we do want him to come to campus and challenge the status quo and the liberal majority opinion here. Mr. Yiannopoulos often uses humor, and he also uses humor in response to people calling him a terrible range of names and slurs, white supremacist, Nazi, white nationalist. You really can't expect someone to just take those insults without responding. I think if you're going to stand up there and slander Mr. Yiannopoulos and not use facts and rational arguments to debate him, and if you're just going to call him names, then maybe you should expect the same back from Mr. Yiannopoulos.
That's Troy Warden, who is a member of the Berkeley College Republicans and a junior at Berkeley. Troy, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.